This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the world teeters on the brink of war between nuclear powers over Syria, but much of the left seems to have lost its interest in foreign policy. The Uhuru movement holds a national conference in Ferguson, and protesters demand that the U.S. stop propping up the dictatorship in Ethiopia. But first, the national prison strike that began on September 9th continues, although the corporate media has almost completely ignored the story. Pastor Kenneth Glasgow is the chief spokesman on the outside for the Free Alabama Movement, which spearheaded the strike. Glasgow says the revolt against slave labor behind the bars began in Alabama's Holman prison.
The strike, first and foremost, was initiated, organized, and led by formerly incarcerated people out of Holman, the Free Alabama Movement. The Free Alabama Movement has been the ones that organized it, that initiated it, called for it, did the call to action, and led it. We have to give these guys their props. We have to give them applause because out of a solitary confinement cell, you got a brother named Kinetic Justice, Robert Earl Council, that pretty much headed this whole apparatus that led to 24 different states, 40 to 50 different prisons getting involved and engaged in the work stoppage and stopping free prison labor. And one of the reasons that I'm making sure that we highlight that is because, you know, you got a whole lot of different organizations, unions like the IWW and all that, that is getting a lot of publicity for work rendered that didn't happen. They came in and they helped, and we thank them for their help. But they're not the ones that initiated, not the ones that organized, and not the ones that called it to action or led it. It was all done by those on the inside of Holman prison in Alabama, Free Alabama Movement.
Now, the strike, of course, has not gotten very much publicity. It's now September 23rd. What is the extent of the strike, as far as you know?
As far as I know now, we still have 11 states that are still involved and engaged, and that's in Alabama, Texas, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. I can't name them all, but there's 11 states that have checked in. Some are California, some of them are on hunger strikes, some of them are still doing the work stoppage, and believe it or not, even in home in prison, you had an officer that died that had nothing to do with the strike, but because of that death, officers at Holman started siding, I mean actually joining on the side with the Free Alabama Movement, those inmates' side, because they see the severity of why they're doing this, and they also see that Holman, the Alabama Department of Corrections, is creating a hostile environment. And that hostile environment is being created for the very reasons that they went on strike in the first place. The free prison labor, first and foremost, because you're working these guys at Holman Prison, to be exact, they have to make a quota of 20,000 license plates a day, 20,000 license plates a day, to meet their quota of 100,000 license plates a week, which is a $1.7 billion industry, a business that's making money off these guys. Some of them are getting paid less than a dollar. Some of them are getting paid 15 cents. Some of them are not getting paid at all. What people have to realize is that people that's in prison are doing all the electricity, all the plumbing, all the construction work, all the yard work and everything, the feeding, the laundry, all that is done by those that are in prison. And if they do the work stoppage and those brothers and sisters stop working that are inmates, then it's up to the guards to do it. At some particular times during this last 3-week stint, you have had 7 guards, 7 correctional officers to run a compound that has 1,900 inmates. 7 total. Even the wardens and all have been pulled out of their offices and administrative buildings for them to walk the halls and do work turning keys.
The overall theme of the strike is, of course, to end the perpetuation of slavery within the prison system.
Exactly. That's where I was going. the overall reason for them having the strike in the first place is to end slavery once and for all. Slavery is still written in our books. The 13th Amendment, which was meant to abolish slavery, actually still upholds it and gives an exception for it by saying no one could be held under involuntary servitude except apply for felony conviction or enslaved. So that keeps it on the books. That leaves us in the potential to be enslaved and be held under involuntary servitude. And this is why brothers and sisters have took it upon themselves to do so and have a work stoppage. That work stoppage has really and truly went across the nation. A lot of the mainstream media is not producing it, but we know why. I mean, come on, this Black Agenda Report, you know why the mainstream media are not talking about it? Because most of the mainstream media support and money and funders that they get is from private industries and companies that are using what? Free prison labor. You know, I hate to disturb our women, but Victoria's Secret, like, I love McDonald's, but McDonald's, I love Walmart. Walmart has in his laws, you know, in his hiring practices that we don't have or use any kind of prison labor. Yeah, but your products, all the products that you got, some of them use prison labor. And the other thing that they're doing is they got the media, these private companies and industries got the media stating a fact that, oh, we're outsourcing. The reason that there's so much unemployment and that it's so hard to get a job is because we're outsourcing our products and outsourcing our businesses to foreign countries. Well, let's stop the bamboozle. They're not outsourcing, they're insourcing, using free prison labor. You know, we have a young lady that got locked up in solitary confinement because she told the media that she was the one that took the tags off a maid in Japan and put on that maid in USA. See, these are the kind of things that's going on that don't nobody know. Taxpayers don't say, hey, well, you know, they're prisoners. They don't have no rights. Well, guess what, taxpayers? You're paying anywhere from $31,000 to $80,000 a year to keep people incarcerated. And they're not getting any kind of rehabilitation, no kind of education, no kind of trade, skill, training, or anything like that in order for them to come out and be productive citizens. And then with that same money that you're paying to warehouse these people that you think can be rehabilitated, they're using them for free prison labor. So anybody that say that they have no rights is clearly saying that we approve and we endorse prison slavery and slavery and free prison labor.
Now, this is a nationwide strike, and so there must be specific demands in different prisons, different prison systems. But at Holman, what are some of the more specific demands beyond, of course, abolishing the system as it exists?
Well, first and foremost, these are the same demands that Holman is asking for will super extend to most states across the country. They're asking them to look at the life without parole. Some states don't even have life without parole. But they're asking Alabama to look at their laws pertaining to life without parole, and if your state is one of the states that do so, then you need to look at those laws. 98% of the people that go to prison get out. 98%. We have people that commit these white-collar crimes and murder crimes and all kind of, and they get out when they're white, but when they're black, you know, they get life without parole and never get out. Okay? That's first and foremost. The second thing they're talking about is the Habitual Offender Act. Most of our states, especially those in the South, are 200% in Alabama, especially 200% over capacity. 200% over capacity. And one of the biggest contributors to that, at least 30% in every state that you go in, is the Habitual Offender Act. So we ask some people in Alabama as well as all over the country to look at their Habitual Offender Act laws. Then we ask some people to look at their juvenile laws, laws that pertain to juveniles and adjudicate juveniles as adults and keep them in prison. One of the things that Alabama was proud to talk about is this recidivism rate. Oh, we only have a 30% recidivism rate. Well, of course you only got a 30% recidivism rate because you got longer sentences than any other state. And then last but not least, one of the other things that people are looking at is they got an Innocence Inquiry Commission. And they're asking yours, if your state don't have an Innocence Inquiry Commission, then please ask them to get one But look at that, because here in Alabama, the Innocence Inquiry Commission only pertains to those on death row. So you mean to tell me a person that get 2 years, but just because they're not on death row and they're not guilty, they still don't get looked at or assessed or evaluated? You know, so those are the things that they're asking them to look at. What we're asking them to look at on the outside, and myself as a national spokesperson for FAM, the Free Alabama Movement and all, what we're asking is for people to go beyond that. And what I mean by go beyond that is we want them to go ahead and be looking at, can people vote? We want them to be looking at people's votes. You know, people can vote out of jail and prison. I just did a video with John Legend about you can vote. Just because you have a felony conviction, you can still vote. It don't matter whether you have a felony conviction. We need to check out the laws in your state. Because most of the people that got misdemeanors that are in city jails, they still can vote. And most of the people that's in county jail, they haven't even been to court yet. Otherwise, they'll be convicted and sent to prison. So they can still vote.
In terms of prison labor, do you want to abolish prison labor or do you just demand decent wages?
No, we want to totally abolish prison labor as it stands. Totally. Totally abolishing prison labor as it stands and getting to a point to where no one is working for free. This is what we have to get to. We have to get to a point where no one is working for free, and we abolish slavery as it stands, still clearly in our Constitution in America. We're not trying to unionize, not trying to get no union, not trying to join up with the union. We are totally asking from the Free Alabama Movement to abolish slavery and free prison labor.
And how long do you think inmates are prepared to continue this action?
They're prepared to continue as long as they can. And one of the things that will be, you'll be looking forward to, I'll be doing an interview with me sometime in the near future, we will start boycotting some of these industries and these companies that use prison labor, starting with the ones that benefit from them the most on down to the ones that benefit the least.
So you're going to come up with a list of these offending corporations?
Oh, yeah, we have a list that's already on my website, theordinarypeoplesociety.org. Theordinarypeoplesociety.org. There's a list already out.
And would that entail picketing of the outlets of these offending corporations?
Most definitely. The other thing that will be happening is mothers and families is also getting together to start addressing sending money into the prison. See, a lot of people don't realize that. They talk about the contraband cell phones and all that, but people have to realize that the cell phones are sold to the inmates by guards, $500 a hit, and then when they get caught with one, the Department of Corrections charges them $25, $50 for getting caught with one. So one of the things that the prisons also survive off is all the interest in the money that people send to put on the books for those that are incarcerated. So if the mothers and the families stop sending money in to those that are incarcerated, for them to put on their books and hold in commissary, then that's going to take away a lot of the money that these prison systems are getting. In Georgia, for instance, they get a dollar every time they do a transaction for administrative fee. So all the money that you're sending in or people sending in for their loved ones, the Department of Corrections is not only making the interest off that money, but they're also charging them for doing any kind of transaction with that money.
So they not only exploit the slave labor of the inmates inside, but they suck in revenue from the families.
Exactly, and exploit the families as well. And one of the things that is very, very disturbing to us is not only the exploitation by these private businesses, private companies, not only the convict leasing that have been going on that don't nobody want to talk about in the contracts with the Department of Corrections, these prisons, and the contracts with these companies. We also got one of the worst scenarios in existence, and that's a lot of our black legislators got stuck in the prison. And that's very disturbing. We will be also doing report cards and not only making a list of what companies using free prison labor, but how many of our legislators are making money off stock off using free prison labor.
So you're going to name names and shame those legislators that are collaborators in the system.
I'm going to name names. They done shamed themselves, sir.
If Pastor Kenneth Glasgow sounds like Reverend Al Sharpton, it's because that's his brother. The Obama administration has spent billions of dollars waging a proxy war against the government of Syria in a conflict that has killed hundreds of thousands of people and now threatens to ignite a war with Russia. 2 weeks ago, U.S. warplanes attacked a Syrian military base, killing over 60 government soldiers who were fighting the Islamic State. We spoke with Du Boisian scholar and veteran political activist Dr. Anthony Monteiro and asked if he believed Washington's claim that the bombing was a mistake.
Well, of course not. It was not a mistake. It was the Pentagon's response to the ceasefire and peace accords, at least temporarily, between Lavrov and John Kerry, the Russian foreign minister and the U.S. Secretary of State. And they were sending a message. Ash Carter and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dunford, they were sending a message that they don't want peace in Syria, that they're waiting until the election is decided, and then there will be a new approach to Syria where the United States will attempt to impose a no-fly zone, and even if that means confronting the Russian Air Force, which would mean a big power confrontation over Syria, which could easily spin out of control into something far bigger than anyone imagines and would bring us, interestingly, close to a situation similar to what the world confronted in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis, a crisis that occurred almost 54 years ago now. So I think we're in dangerous territory. I think there is a deep split within the administration. For the most part, Obama is pretty much out of the picture. And then the State Department, the department that is supposedly dealing with diplomacy, is split. Because if you watch the performance over the weekend of U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Powers, who walked out of the Security Council session called by the Russians to investigate the U.S. Air Force's bombing of the Syrian Arab Army's base. She walked out and attacked the Russians and blamed them for everything going on in Syria, literally blamed the Russians for the U.S. bombing of the Syrian Army, and in a very belligerent manner and a very hostile manner, made it clear that she, Samantha Powers, was on the side of Ash Carter, the U.S. Defense Secretary, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in their preparation for war in Syria with Russia.
And the Russians were, of course, understandably alarmed. They asked the undiplomatic question of, who is in charge in Washington? The Defense Department? The Pentagon? Who?
Absolutely. You know, Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, held a press conference at the UN after he spoke there on behalf of the Russian Federation. And while he was attempting to be diplomatic, it was clear that he was raising the question of who was in charge. And that's what everybody is asking, who's in charge in Washington? Now, obviously, I think it's obvious to me, it's not Obama. But clearly, the forces of war, the party of war, is waiting for the outcome of the election. And I'm certain most of them assume or are betting on Hillary Clinton being the next president. And of course, we know Hillary Clinton's position on Syria. As far back as 2011, she was calling for a no-fly zone and a type of Libyan solution to the West Syrian problem. And of course, Samantha Powers, who is the author of the Powers Doctrine of the right to intervene on so-called humanitarian grounds wherever the United States chooses to. And that was the doctrine that was used to justify the intervention in Libya. And once again, I would underline this right to intervene, which means that the United States could supersede international law and even the UN Security Council and take matters into its own hands. It is possible that if Clinton is elected, that Samantha Powers would either be her Secretary of State or perhaps her National Security Advisor. Nonetheless, it is clear that the Clinton foreign policy would be guided by the Pentagon and her own predisposition to settle accounts in the Middle East and with the Assad government and with Russia militarily.
As the former Defense Secretary Gates informed us, a no-fly zone is not just a declaration. U.S. military doctrine requires that when it declares a no-fly zone, it must then proceed to destroy the aircraft and anti-aircraft capability of the country that it's declared against. In Libya, that was just Gaddafi's forces. But in Syria, we're talking about Russians.
Oh, yeah. And as you know, the Russians not only have air bases in Syria, and I would add in Iran, that are used against ISIL and the al-Nusra Front and the other terrorist organizations, but the Russians some months ago installed in Syria F-300 anti-missile and anti-aircraft defense facilities. These are considered to be among the most advanced anti-aircraft defense facilities known in the world today. So I think that to enforce a no-fly zone in Syria would mean not only attacking the Syrian Air Force, but it would mean attacking the Russian Air Force and the Russian missile and air defense installations within Syria. That type of attack would be tantamount to a declaration of war or an act of war against Russia. As you already know, the tensions between Russia and the United States are not only in Syria, but certainly in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic states, where NATO and primarily U.S. forces are right on the borders of Russia. And of course, all of the talk about bringing Ukraine into NATO and the placing of U.S. nuclear-armed missiles in Poland and in other Eastern European countries only heightens this possibility of war between Russia and the United States. In fact, my opinion is that the most important question in this election is the question of war and peace. For that reason, I have felt for some time that Hillary Clinton has to be defeated no matter what it takes or whoever it takes to do it, because of the two major candidates, Hillary Clinton is, and the forces around her, and this big tent that she's now at the top of, this big tent is the tent of American imperialism, American militarism, and war with Russia and or China or both at the same time.
Well, what does the war party, which is, of course, clustered around Hillary Clinton, what does it think it's about? There is clearly no war fervor in the United States. The Trump folks have not dumped their candidate because he said he was against regime change. And we don't see a great war fervor among the ranks of Democrats. Where is the sanction for this kind of saber rattling?
Well, you see, I think the Democratic Party is very sophisticated in using methods of distraction, of methods of saying one thing and, of course, doing the very opposite. Of course, Obama was the great distraction where he talked peace but pursued war and so on. But what they would do is to find every justification to say that the United States is threatened by Russia and to use a version of the Samantha Powers doctrine to say that the Syrian population is threatened by the Russians and the Syrian army and so on, and thus the right to humanitarian intervention. But you're right. The people of the United States and the majority of the military, in a recent study conducted by Military Times and Syracuse University, found that 55% of the U.S. military strongly or somewhat opposes policies of continual war and regime change. So even at the level of the rank and file of the operational forces in the U.S. military, the majority are against the policies of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Pentagon, and the top brass of the military. So I conceive this as a form of a political clash between classes. In other words, a reflection or manifestation of class conflict over foreign policy, over questions of war and peace, not to mention questions of neoliberal trade policies like TPP, which would immiserate and impoverish the American working class.
Well, let's be clear about which classes are intent on war.
The class intent upon war is the class represented by Hillary Clinton, and that is what we euphemistically call the 1%. We're talking about the financial oligarchy, and we're talking about that tiny section of the global population that sees the possibility of establishing a regime of domination of the world through its control of finance, cyber space, and of military forces. That's who we're talking about. On the other side are the majority of the people, and a growing majority, especially working people who have suffered under policies of war, austerity, and neoliberal globalization, i.e. policies of trade based upon treaties like NAFTA and Trans-Pacific Partnership and TIPP.
And the Russia-phobia has gone so far that the Clinton supporters seem to be saying that the Russians are about to disrupt the American electoral process.
Absolutely. And that is part of the propaganda of war. And if you understand it in this period or in previous periods of the Cold War, that you establish an external enemy, in this case Russia, previously the Soviet Union, which will then, and I put quotes, justify war and military buildup, and thus calling upon the American people to make sacrifices for security. Now, it's not just Russia. Russia is the main target, but it's also China. And interesting, North Korea and Iran. So we're getting to this thing of what the U.S. military planners call full spectrum domination, their ability to wage multiple wars on multiple fronts with multiple adversaries. This is very dangerous. And Hillary Clinton and her big tent are the ones that are pushing this and think this is a realistic approach to world problems.
Yes, U.S. military planning calls for the U.S. to be able to wage 2.5 wars, 2 major wars with 2 major adversaries, and a half war with a smaller adversary. It seems like they're lining up their adversaries right now.
That's right. And the adversaries, if you want to call them that, are lining up to prepare to defend themselves. And of course, you know, the newly emerging China-Russia strategic alliance, and now the China-Russia-Iran strategic alliance. I think they understand what Syria represents. And we heard only about a month ago that the Chinese are supporting the Russians in Syria. Of course, the Iranians have permitted the use of military or air bases in Iran to fly missions into Syria against ISIL and al-Nusra Front in defense of the Assad government. And what we're not yet clear upon is where will Turkey come down in all of this after the U.S. supported, at least after it was in process, the U.S. supported a failed coup d'etat against the Erdogan government.
So here domestically, we hear all kinds of talk about lesser evilism, but there can be no greater evil than the destruction of the world through war.
That's right. That's right. And we're talking about major powers, all of whom possess nuclear weapons. The Russians have already said that if NATO threatens the existence of their state, they have the right to use nuclear weapons. China has not said that, but they have called upon the U.S. Navy to back off in the South China Sea. The government of the Philippines, who went to the World Court, to The Hague, to challenge Chinese island building and occupation of islands in the South China Sea, and one in The Hague, has said politically, however, that they are with China against the United States and called for the United States Special Forces to leave the Philippines. So this is a very fluid situation. Now, will the forces of war in the United States be so foolhardy to challenge a emerging alliance of forces who disagree on many things, but agree on one thing, that they oppose American militarism and war and belligerency? Will the people like the Ash Carters and the Hillary Clintons and the Samantha Powers and on be so crazy as to push this thing beyond the point of no return? That's why I think we on the left, and especially the black left, have to begin to raise the question of war and peace as a central question in this election. Of course, the corporate media and the Clinton campaign wish to distract from that. We have to put those issues back at the center of the discussion in this upcoming election.
Dr. Anthony Monteiro, speaking from Philadelphia. The Uhuru Movement held its annual conference in Ferguson, Missouri this month. Kalambayi Andanet is president of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. She says the liberation movement must be based among the same people that it wants to set free.
I love the trap house. I love the hood. I love them because they know what's going on. They really do. And that's why we say that the poor working class got to lead the struggle, because they have a significant stake in this. Because the petty bourgeoisie, the people that got things, feel like they invested in America. So they okay with a couple of people getting a good job. Even if they don't have a good job, just to know another Negro got one is okay with them. And that's the situation that we have. But I'm invested in not just a couple of Negroes getting a good job. I'm invested in my kids having a real future. I'm invested in my kids having a real future. A real one. You know, like, this is not real. I don't know if you haven't woke up and realized that if somebody could come out and touch your kid and you can't do nothing about it, that don't make you feel good. You know what I'm saying? I don't know how you okay with that. And so the task at hand is we have to build, and we have to be part of something that's real. And we have to move beyond ourselves. And I heard people at the trap house, they say one thing, I'm with you, sister. Man, you on point. You on point, sister. You got it. Yes. And I say, okay, now, we having a convention, and I need you to come. Oh, no, sis, you know, I ain't down with all that. You know, just when it pop off, I got your back. I say this to them. It's an art to war. And if you just heard what I said about our enemy, that he's organized, that we have been colonized for 600 years to the point that we are oblivious and being complacent for this long, how do you think you're going to know how to aim? Ain't nobody, you can't go to the military and say, yeah, just give me my gun and I'm ready to go shoot. No, that's not going to happen. They're going to indoctrinate you. They're going to help you understand what's the whole point of why you're going to this war, even if it didn't make sense. But they're going to tell you that. You know what I'm saying? They're going to make you hate who they hate. You know what I'm saying? They're going to give you a blueprint and say, this is how we moving. You ask questions later. Your captain say, go to the left, you move to the left. And you understand why. Because you understand that lives would be dead if you don't move that way. So why in the hell do you think you're going to aim or know what to do if you don't get organized in so-called peace? And you know what kind of peace we having. Then every time we can't go down our Facebook page, we can't open up anything and see our people not suffering. Forget Facebook. When you go home into your house and the mail hits you in the door and you never have enough money to pay them. Well, I'm here to tell you that it's not because God didn't love you. It's not because you did something wrong. You didn't. It's because you colonized. And that's the way it was supposed to do. And it's nothing you can do to change that in this system. The thing that you, how you can change it is come into this organization, understand what it is, have your own theory. We've been borrowing theory from everybody. Because we have not had somebody to lay out our interests. What is our interest? What? So we need is our own theory. And that's African internationalism. What is that? What is that? That's why you're here today. You're going to get a taste. And once you get a taste, you have to continue to feed yourself. Because that's the only way that you can really know and when stuff happen and pop off, that you will say, you know what? I still got to move. My man leave me, I still got to move. My girl don't like me no, I still got to move. My mom, sorry, I got to move. Because I got a one-track mind and I see freedom. And that's what it got to be.
That was Kalambayi and Danette. The International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement is part of the African People's Socialist Party, led by Omali Yeshitela. He said the current movement is a continuation of the struggle that began 600 years ago with the European assault on Africa.
They were engaged in an incredible economic enterprise that was a thing that grew the political economy of the world today. The economy of the world today that we experience came about primarily as a consequence of the capture and trade in black party. We were an economic interest as far as they were concerned. And when we met Europeans, when we met white people, there was no freedom. White people had no freedom, had no resources at all. In fact, they were living under what is known as feudalism, a starving Europe, a disease-ridden Europe that had nothing but poverty and ignorance on top of that. And it was a consequence of Europeans leaving a very hostile environment, socially, politically, and otherwise, and venturing out to Africa, Mother Africa, where all humanity has its origin, came to Africa. And I want to mention that because people think and act like they think that poverty and despair is natural to Africa. But what I want to say is that if human life began in Africa, then obviously poverty and despair is not natural, not normal. Life is natural and life is normal. And that if there is a lack of life, if there's an assault on life in Africa today, it is not because it's normal, but because something, somebody has intervened in Africa to impoverish Africa, to impoverish Africans, and to put us in the circumstances that we live in today. So, what we had was a situation where Europe was starving and impoverished and diseased. Was no democracy. In fact, what happened was democracy that we, as we know it today, came about as a consequence of slavery and colonialism. Even as we are having this discussion right now, in North Dakota, thousands of indigenous people are attempting to defend themselves from one of the most, from the latest egregious assault on them. I mention this because we are talking about how this whole social system got set up. It's a parasitic social system. It's called capitalism. Capitalism was born parasitic. It was born as a consequence of taking the land of the indigenous peoples here. It was born as a consequence of stealing half of Mexico. They're talking about Trump wants to put a wall up. Hell, you've stolen half of Mexico already, and that's part of the way that all the Mexicans are starving and all of the white people are doing better than Mexicans. And of course, the assault on Africa and African people. So we're in this circumstance today as a consequence of how the whole social system itself got started. White people think of themselves today. How they think of themselves is a consequence of how they have defined us and how they have defined the rest of the world in relationship to them. If they did otherwise, they would have to say, we got everything that we have today because there are groups of people living in concentration camps through all this territory. Some of them they'll call housing projects. Some of them are called prisons. Some of them are called Indian reservations. They would say that the reason I can hope and assume that my child will have a future is because we've denied a future to the Africans. We've denied a future to the so-called Indians. We've denied a future to the Indians. We've denied a future to the Mexicans and various other peoples around the world. They would have to say that, but they can't say that. And so an ideology, a belief system has been spawned by slavery and colonialism that raises up white people to this extraordinary, insane, absolutely absurd position that's better than anybody else on the planet. That all things good are supposed to happen to white people. And that's why you have a Santa Claus as an explanation of all the wealth that white people have and all the poverty that nobody else has. Unearned wealth is what you call it. So here you have a social system, but everything that folk have, everything that's in the bank, the whole stock market comes into existence through selling black people. The first stock was us, you see. And so if white people don't like you, it's because it's convenient not to like you. Because otherwise, they'd have to explain why they've stolen every damn thing from you, keep you starving, and deny your children the right to have a future. So what we have is an explanation. Various kinds of explanations we've had. Some of them called Darwinian. This is extraordinary. This Darwinian assumption says that white people have everything because white people are smarter. It's the survival of the fittest. That's like saying that Al Capone represents survival of the fittest in relationship to the local banks, or John Dillinger in relationship to the local banks. This is how you define normalcy, normalcy. When you're the crook, crime is normal. And so we're a revolutionary organization. And some time ago, we came to the conclusion that we won't share power, shouldn't share power over our lives with any damn body. That if anybody is going to govern, rule black people, it's got to be black people ourselves.
Omali Yeshitela at the Uhuru Movement Conference in Ferguson, Missouri. In recent months, the one-party ethnic dictatorship in Ethiopia has killed hundreds of protesters from the Amhara and Oromo groups. Ethiopia is a main U.S. ally in Africa, despite its horrific human rights record.
Sisirega Mulugeta is the U.S.-based vice president of the Ethiopian People's Congress of Struggle, or SHENGO.
For the past 25 years, an oligarchy system, perhaps a neo-black authoritarian regime under the name of EPRDF, but dominated by TPLF, the Tigrayan Liberation Front, which make up only 6% of the population, have been exercising its authoritarian power and won 5 consecutive times the election in Ethiopia. As you know, the foundation of any democratic regime is free and fair election, and those have been absent in Ethiopia. So this situation that arose now, the past 11 months ago, by the Oromo region protesters, resulted in the killings of perhaps from 600 to 800 people. That was also anchored on the issue of self-identity and the right for fundamental right to access to land use, to economic use, to political participation. That same movement spread it out, ignited what for the past perhaps 40 years, meaning before the TPLF government came to power, they had a burning issue that they have, that to want to have occupy the fertile lands of Gondar, that's in the northern part, which is called Amara, the origin of Amara, and Gojam, that's another Amara region, and Wollo, and all that area, which is fertile land that goes up to Gambela. These areas have been their interest. So during their rebel years, they have been planning to map out and took over those areas. So when they came to power 25 years ago, they have decided to occupy those lands to get rid of some of the Amara's people by the use of sterilizing injections in some places, detention, killings, arrests, and other words, ethnic cleansing, that they were able to extend their distasteful hate ruling in the past 40 years. It was about in July, there was an issue that's been brewing in the area of northern Amhara region again, that they wanted to have their own identity to occupy the land that they were born. They lived with their children and families for a generation to live there, to be left alone. But the government refused to allow them their identity or human rights respected. So people rose up. The uprising broke. And finally, some picked up arms, some just empty-handed in fighting against a military occupation of the Ethiopian government. So that's why the UN, as well as the United Nations, under H.R. 861 bill on 9/12/16 was introduced by Congressman Chris Smith and other congresses to help secure peace in Ethiopia, in fact, to stop this violence, to allow investigators to come into the country and secure peace, to actually normalize the situation and to gratify the demands of the protesters and allow to have openness of democratic institutions.
So why do you think the United States has a special responsibility with regard to the situation in Ethiopia?
Because, number one, Ethiopia is the closest ally in the fight against terrorism. The reason why there's need to be expediency in stopping this violence is if it continued, it would destabilize the regions in East Africa. That includes Somalia, Djibouti, Ethiopia, the Sudan, and Kenya, which the United States has military interests and national interests in the area, and they would not want that to go south. Ethiopia, the largest foreign aid recipient, I think next to Israel, perhaps $1.2 billion a year has been funded to Ethiopia. So it is in the interest of the United States taxpayers to voice themselves, to say that no to crime against humanity in Ethiopia. The United States money or fund should not be used by the Ethiopian government to terrorize its own people instead of securing the region. So if we continue to do so, no one is going to win. It's going to be an area that would hatch a bunch of terrorists in that area, which not only dangerous to Ethiopia and the region, also to the United States' national interest.
Until the mid-70s, the Amhara were the dominant group in Ethiopia.
It's only the ruling class, of the Amhara, perhaps, which, if we can talk who was an Amhara and who was not, it's a different story. Even Haile Selassie was part Amhara, part Guragi, and also part Oromo. These are major Ethiopian ethnic groups. However, the language was paramountly used in the country, Amharic. However, 95% of the Amhara people have been oppressed. So the Amhara were supposedly the dominant party, but the majority of the Amharas, in fact, were below the bottom. So this is a misconception.
In terms of these mass protests, are we seeing a common cause between the Amhara and the Oromo? And one should not leave out of the equation the Somali residents of Ethiopia in the Ogaden, who have also been in armed opposition to the government for some time.
Let's go back a little bit. The Oromos and the Amharas are totally and absolutely intermarried. If we go back to who Ethiopia, what Ethiopia has been, it has the history of the longest intermarriage and relationship and cultural and shared vision. So either you have your father is an Amhara, your mother could be an Oromo. So it is not difficult for the two ethnic groups to come together. The issue is that when this government, the TPLF government, 25 years ago came to power, it used its ethnic federal policy to divide the country. If you are a certain ethnic group, you're not allowed to go to another area, invest, or live as part of that population. Say, if you live in New Jersey, if you are a certain ethnic group, you cannot move to New York with your family if you get a job in New York or so, and or share investment in that country. It is disincentive for development. It is bad. It actually helps to divide the country. This government uses the exact replication of colonization, the partition of Africa prior to colonization. That's how they did it. They divided on ethnic and racial basis. So this government, the TPLF government, took over that model and applied 25 years ago to divide Ethiopia into ethnic lines, into nine states that have, each state have its own army. It gets better. The constitution that they put forward starts with a preamble saying nations and nationalities as opposed to we the people. If any place in the world, Ethiopia being the oldest country in the world, should have been the frame reference of unity and integrity, we should have said we the people, but not the nation and nationalities, although nine different countries are living together, separating husband and wife, children and mother. The dominating power used Article 39, which is self-determination up to secession. Where are you going to go to from your own motherland? Who are you going to be? It's a loss of identity and crisis that caused us. And they made sure that these nine different states would have the choice to secede any day. from the Union, from Ethiopia, from their own motherland. However, any part of the Constitution would not be amended unless 100% of the council members approve it. This is unheard. This is the only country in the world that has Article 39 that would allow the breakage of its own country.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.